Why not become a My Perfect Console Patreon supporter? For just $5 a month, you will get your episodes early and ad-free. You'll get access to the members-only My Perfect Console community lounge. You'll receive guest announcements exclusively before the general public. You can pitch questions to future guests, download bonus episodes in which guests answer those questions, and vote in the annual My Perfect Console Best Console of the Year knockout competition, coming later in 2023. Hop along to www.patreon.com/myperfectconsole and become a supporter.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is an English comedian, actor, and one of the most prolific joke writers in the UK. He first made a room laugh as a young child at his aunt's wedding, when during the ceremonial speeches, the other guests overheard him speaking to his mother. Then, while a student at the University of Sheffield, he again became an accidental stand-up, when at the last minute, he filled in for the compere at a comedy event. Since then, he's delighted audiences with his rapid-fire joke-telling, both at the Edinburgh Festival, where he has been nominated for the Best Show Comedy Award, and on television, as a regular panellist on BBC's Mock the Week, ITV's The Stand-Up Sketch Show, and most recently, the new US series The Great American Joke-Off. My guest is also a presenter on BBC's video games TV show and podcast, Press X to Continue, for which he has completed more than 100 games every year since 2020. Welcome, Glenn Moore.
Thank you so much for having me, Simon. I really appreciate it.
Ah, that's super kind. Yeah, I had Phil Wang on the show a few weeks ago, and at the end of our conversation, I asked him, who should I get on here? And without hesitating, he immediately brought your name up.
So oh, nice.
I'm super glad we could make it work.
Phil and I were involved in a charity wrestling event for Comic Relief a couple of months ago, and I think he arrived there from having just done this podcast and was like, you've got to do this podcast. You've got to listen to this podcast. And since then, I've listened to every single episode, and I'm so grateful to be here. So thank you.
Ah, that's really nice of you. Well, with that out of the way, I'm going to actually make you jump off the deep end a bit. I wonder if we could return to that scene of your childhood trauma.
Yeah, thanks.
At your aunt's wedding.
Thank you so much.
Do you remember what happened, and can you tell us the story?
I don't know where you stumbled across that. Yeah, I remember it vividly. It was I was a very shy child, and I was 5 years old, and I was a page boy at my aunt and uncle's wedding in Scotland.
Were you wearing a kilt?
I was wearing a kilt, sporran, long, itchy socks. I remember it horribly. Blue pants, don't know why I remember that. I just remember all of it. And I think my parents were worried I was going to be restless and bored throughout the wedding. And my dad gave me this little tiny toy car that was sort of like a little, it was sort of like a regular car, but then if you pressed down on it, it became like a convertible, and it sort of fit perfectly in my sporran. And that sort of kept me occupied for most of the dinner. And during the dinner, which was in this huge square of maybe about 150, 200 guests. It was a really, really big wedding. I was a bit bored, and my mum was letting me play with one of her sort of hoop bracelets, and I was flicking this toy car, and I flicked it and it went through the hoop. And I said to my mum in what I thought was a really hushed whisper, but it came out incredibly loudly. I just said, "My car just went through the hoop," and it disrupted the father of the bride speech. And it wasn't in any way a funny thing to say. I was just saying what I saw, and I was really excited, but that it disrupted the speech, and the entire room erupted in like almost angry, aggressive laughter is the way I've sort of remembered it. And I remember just burying my face in my mum's, just so mortified and humiliated. And it was weird. I remember talking to my stand-up director and separately to my girlfriend about it. On both times I mentioned that instance, they were both like, "Oh, that's why you do comedy."
Right.
That's 100% psychologically why you do comedy, is to make sure that, you know, laughter is only ever going to hopefully be done on your terms.
Right, right, right.
It's obviously played some huge psychological effect on you.
Yeah.
And has dictated the way you live your life. And I was like, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Probably. Because I remember feeling so deeply embarrassed.
It's such an interesting origin story, because I've had a few comedians on this show, and almost all of them describe the first time they stood in front of a crowd and got a big laugh, and how essentially it sort of set their brain on fire, and then the rest of their career has been spent trying to chase that high, as it were.
Yeah.
But for you, it's sort of the opposite way around, right?
You had
this experience, and then you've been almost trying to run away from it ever since, or control it or something.
Yeah, it's Bruce Wayne dressing up as a bat, isn't it? It's the only way I could sort of confront it. I think that's probably why. I did enjoy trying to make people laugh, and had enjoyed that sort of throughout my whole life as something to attempt. But that was just a really early iteration of, this isn't fun laughter. This is, I feel really put on the spot. I feel very exposed,
I think. But people don't laugh angrily, Glenn. They weren't doing that.
I know, exactly. It felt like a really angry mad king, but hundreds of them. You know, it was a real like, look at the buffoon. It was in my head, that's how I remembered it, when in fact it was just a good-natured interruption.
Yeah, sure.
Of a profoundly weird father of the bride speech. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you been able to forgive 5-year-old Glenn for that interruption?
Stand-up is now, you know, very much my full-time career, so evidently not. So it's fine. It's fine, you know. I'm fine with it being the origin of it, you know. For most people, it is just they watched stand-up and they thought, I'd like to give that a go.
Yeah.
And I think, for me, it was vastly different to that.
Yeah, yeah. So you are a sort of classic joke writer, and, you know, while your work like has a super contemporary feel, I think, but also, you know, probably that format is a bit less prevalent in comedy today. And, you know, lots of the really high profile comedians are a bit more confessional and anecdote based and all of that stuff. Why do you think you prefer that sort of pitter patter joke writing approach, historically at least?
I think it felt more creative, and I had a very, very just regular, dull upbringing. And so was worried that when I first was interested in the idea of doing stand-up potentially, that, well, if you're meant to talk about your life, I'm never going to be able to make anything of myself, because there's nothing exciting that's happened. There's nothing different that's really worth talking about. And similarly, I think I just enjoyed the creative aspect of someone's imagination, of just coming up with, it was always ideas that interested me more than the idea of a sort of someone telling a funny story that happened to them. So that was entirely what drove it. And then I think when it came to writing my first ever stand-up show, I had a director at the time who was obsessed with confessional storytelling and was like, you need your debut show to be your story so far, your biography. And I was completely at loggerheads with that. So I basically wrote a fictionalized biography of myself. And the show was basically just a collection of one-liners, but all fit this sort of cohesive format. And then that, it was purely by that sort of mistake, purely us having a disagreement, that then fully informed my stand-up. So my stand-up style now is sort of faux confessional, but it's all fictionalized stories from my childhood and life.
Right, right.
Because I just sort of thought, yeah, why not make it up? And there's no pretense that it's true. No one in the audience fully believes it's true. There's always a few aspects that are real, and I always try to make sure that those are the least plausible realness, you know, the bits that were real were the bits that you'd be absolutely certain were not. But I just sort of thought, oh, that was different. And I, you know, as I said, I enjoyed seeing joke tellers and not old style jokes, but just really sort of brief, punchy, one-linery sort of jokes. I enjoyed that style, and I started doing it just because I didn't really see a lot of it around. And so I just kind of thought, well, why don't I just try and do it myself, I guess.
This is an extremely basic question that is a bit embarrassing to
What's
ask
your name?
For a professional journalist, but no, but I'm genuinely interested in like how you go about writing a one-liner joke, because it seems like such a technical little thing. Like doing an anecdote or a story, I understand that world like really well, but the technicality of a little joke, it's like making a watch or something. It just seems really alien to me. How do you do that?
But basically, you have to start with a punchline first and work backwards. I think that's why it seems like a sort of strange sort of art form and an impenetrable one, because everyone, you hear a joke forwards, but the reality is obviously you've got to write it backwards. And you sort of work backwards from there. And usually the way I'd write a joke is just taking a sort of a normal thing in one particular context and putting it into a stranger context. So I try to always think of an example. I used to have this joke years ago that was about how this girl was like flirting with me at a bar, and she was eating from this bowl of cherries, and she did something called the cherry stem trick, where you put a cherry stem in your mouth and you tie it into a knot with your tongue. And then she took things one step further. She put a whole Kinder egg in her mouth, pulled out a fully assembled toy. And it was like, well, that was the... It was just a case of, well, that's the... I thought of the idea of people doing the cherry stem thing, and then thought, well, what's a sillier version of that that someone did? Quite, in many ways, making it sound quite lazy, and it probably is. But it's just taking something from one context and putting it into another.
Yeah, no, it's not lazy at all. And also, you've got Kinder eggs are associated with, you know, they're not sexy, are they? So as well,
exactly. There's that element as well. But it was a silly thing, and I think I told that joke on the aforementioned Great American Joke Off and forgot that they're banned in the US. So the rest of the US panelists looked very confused.
So, you know, for people who work in creative fields, like often you find moments of inspiration while you're out for a walk or something like that, or doing like sometimes a repetitive task like playing a video game. Do you ever find inspiration hits while you're playing games?
No, I think there was it was more structurally that I'd get inspired. So it basically through Soulsborne games, the structure of those informed how I wrote callbacks. I'm obsessed with callbacks. Nice. I'm obsessed with structuring a show. I think over the course of an hour long show or longer, like a long sort of tour show, that you can just do a couple of hours of disparate material. But I always thought it's so much more satisfying if it all links together, if everything is relevant to another bit. And then by the end, it's quite fun to write a bespoke closing routine that ties all of those sort of aspects together. And so I always found it, I didn't really enjoy callbacks in people's comedy when I was growing up, because usually I just saw it as the repetition of a joke from earlier and you're just repeating the same thing, and it just seemed like a sort of lazy out, I guess. But actually I thought, well, if you recontextualize it and make sure it's, you know, every word in the callback is different to the original joke, and it's in a different context, then it's suddenly more satisfying and it feels like everything's more organically tied together, in the same way that a satisfying punchline doesn't really share many of the key words from the setup, because you don't really want to repeat any of those words. So I found the first time I think I ever opened a shortcut in Bloodborne or Dark Souls and found, oh my god, I'm back in this area. This is the area from 4 hours previously, and on the other side of this wall, it looked completely different, and I cannot believe this all links to that same area. That suddenly made me sort of think differently about how I could, because you sort of think, well, yeah, but that's creative how From Software have done that, and creativity has different forms in other things. You know, a song can have a callback, a song, you know, and so that kind of informed how I tried to recontextualize jokes and later on. And every time I ever write a joke that's going in a full-length show of mine, I always make sure, can it reappear later on in the show in a fully different context, not in a disingenuous sort of just for the sake of it sort of way, but you can have value if sort of put sort of later on.
Yeah, that's so lovely. Yeah, because I suppose you do, you know, in a FromSoft game, you feel a sense of like a wonder and appreciation of the thoughtful design that's behind it. And that's, yeah, that can be true in callbacks and, you know, not only in comedy, but also in books as well and things in films.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gives you a, you know, just gives you a sense of, oh, there's a craftsperson behind this, which is really nice.
Yeah, exactly. But I kind of wanted, because I know that stand-ups technically meant to feel like this organic, this person's just walked on stage and they're just riffing. They're riffing for an hour and seeing what comes about. But where I sort of always wanted to sort of present myself was, no, I've spent a year writing this. I want you to know I've put a lot of effort into this, and there's no pretending that this isn't scripted to the hilt. This is a soliloquy. This is fully a monologue that, sure, something interesting happens in the room, I'm going to break out of it and mix stuff up and change the structure of a show sort of each night. But ultimately, I'm like, no, I wrote these jokes and I care about them, and I want you to know this is a fully, like, it's also my way of sort of going, please concentrate. please concentrate. Yes.
Yeah. I love that Stuart Lee's got a couple of books out, hasn't he, where it's sort of a transcript of the show, but then he also has footnotes, and it reads, like you say, like it's something that he's coming up with on the spot, but then in the footnotes he's got very detailed, like, oh, at the beginning of the tour I tried it like this,
absolutely.
So you get a real sense of the work that's gone into it. Okay, Glenn, so the format of the podcast is I've asked you to pick the five video games you're going to put on your fictional games machine. Can you just tell me, you emailed me your set of games and you said that you come up with a very specific set of criteria for judging these. Do you want to explain what you meant by
that? Yeah, I think so. Firstly, as I've said, I've gushed about this already, but I love the podcast, and I was immediately trying to sort of think, well, you know, how do I choose these five games? And is it simply my favorite five of all time? Is it an odyssey through my life's gaming journey in which I pick one from the 90s, one from the noughties, one from the 10s, etc. And actually then I started to think, well, I quite like hearing about certain things people look out for in games and certain sensations or experiences and stuff like that. So yeah, I tried to think of five sort of tropes or sensations or emotions that I love to get from games or settings or anything like that, and then try and, as a result, choose the what I see as the epitome of those for me. So as a result, these are all quite recent games because they are the epitome. I think the earliest is probably 2014. But at the same time, I've tried, because there was part of me that didn't really want to be sort of affected too heavily by nostalgia bias, only because I've recently started replaying some of my favorite games from my childhood, and they've just been shit. They've really, and I just think, well, I don't want to spend money in those waters. At the same time, so, you know, there's no Hogs of War or Soul Reaver or Roller Coaster Tycoon, and at the same time, I didn't really want to be affected too much by recency bias. So there's nothing from the past year, even though that if you ask me this in 10 years, Elden Ring or Pentiment or Case of the Golden Idol would probably be on there. But I just wanted to sort of force myself not to. So these experiences that we will talk about are vastly different. So the first one, this one is about the concept of home, and it is Dark Souls 2.
So Dark Souls 2 is often the one that fans of the Dark Souls series sort of say they don't like as much. So tell me why you are bucking that trend.
I love all of them. At the moment of recording, I find it bizarre that only one From Software game has appeared in my perfect console so far. And that was an episode that came out yesterday. So it has baffled me that none have appeared so far. And I think there are people who would be able to talk, who have greater experience over the last decade or so and have far greater knowledge and experience to be able to talk about a much loved one like Dark Souls more eloquently than I can. I am certain no one else will say Dark Souls 2, but I have quite a checkered past with From Software games. The first encounter I ever had with them was actually kind of as early as could have been. My best friend from school, we keep in touch a lot when we're at uni, and he was a real games aficionado and went on to write on No Man's Sky and Divinity Original Sin 2 and stuff like that, and was always just very, very up to date with what games to play. And I remember visiting him once in the summer holidays, and he was like, "I've got two new games for the PS3. You need to try these." And the first one was Demon's Souls, and it wasn't in English. It was just completely new to me, and I hated it so much. It made me so angry, and I remember it so vividly. But it was Boletaria. It was the first. It was 1-1, that first sort of level, and I found it infuriating that the first few enemies are these weak, impoverished skeletons. Yet it was taking me several sword hits to do anything. I mean, after three sword hits, I couldn't do anything more. My friend would be like, "Yeah, you've run out of stamina." And it was like, "Well, what do I do?" And he was like, "Roll away." And it was like, "Oh, because I've run out of stamina, and now they're hitting me, and I can't block because I haven't got any stamina." Mm-hmm. And I just kept dying and dying and dying. And I just went, "Why can't you level up? Why can't you save?" And it was so infuriating. It made me so angry.
Yeah.
And then the other game, he was like, "Well, let's try this other game. It's Bioshock." And we played Bioshock, and I loved it, and immediately fell in love with that. And so I didn't then think about From Software games for years. And then actually started to get angry each time I heard about a new Dark Souls game coming out, because I was like, why are people drinking this Kool-Aid? It's crap. The games look bleak and ugly, and they're hard, it seems, for the sake of it. And then in lockdown, I forced myself to play. I bought Dark Souls for the Switch and played it on just the fully handheld Switch, never plugged it into the TV at any point. And I'm always obsessed with the sort of the click, the moment that it just hits you of what works with these games. I think for me, it's probably unlocking a shortcut in Dark Souls, and suddenly I just really got into it. And then from there, then did Dark Souls 3, then Bloodborne and Sekiro. And then because I'd heard Dark Souls 2 wasn't really the best in the series, I just sort of left it behind and then tried it. And I'd fallen in love with all of them by this point, and I saw Dark Souls 2 as no different. Now, this is the Scholar of the First Sin edition, so it's a lot, you know, they by this point have tidied up some of the stuff that people didn't like.
Yeah.
But a lot of the issues people have with Dark Souls 2 weren't really the sort of things I was interested in with Dark Souls anyway. And I've never really fully engaged with the storyline, because the way I sort of see it was I quite enjoy the idea of being this foreigner in a strange land where you're picking up snippets and...
Yep.
Because that's kind of how Miyazaki had sort of seen it initially in the first place. And I'd listened to so many podcasts and read so much lore about Dark Souls, and the fact that people still haven't reached a consensus on what it's fully about makes me think, well, okay, fine, it's not meant to be.
Yeah.
It's not meant to be fully understood. So I was happy just having a vague understanding and sort of going through. And what really I loved about it was for me, Dark Souls 2 was the first time I approached one of those games with confidence, and I went in and I really felt in charge and on top of it. And it is it's probably for me is the most challenging of the trio, but my attitude had completely changed to it, and I quite enjoyed how that had sort of progressed. The first Dark Souls I played basically as it is true survival horror, and I was treating the game as if there was a wasp in the room, and I had my shield up at all points, treading so carefully, and every time an enemy even took a swing at me, it was like, "Oh god, okay." And I was so lazy in the first game that I would hang around. If I saw a fog gate, I would hang around until I saw a summon sign. I wouldn't even try on my own. I wouldn't even try. And then I'd let the two summons deal with it on their own. I was pathetic. And and then Dark Souls 2 was the first time I just thought, no, let's fully do this. In terms of the concept of home and how that sort of ties in, I love the idea of having a hub, a central hub that you sort of have to return to. It was something that I wish that the more recent GTAs kept up. I loved the fact that in San Andreas or Vice City, when you finished a mission, you still then have to go home to save. And it was like walking. It reminded me of any time I've ever done a gig in a dodgy area and I've been paid in cash and I'm walking through the dodgy area with cash in my wallet and I'm really nervous. And that's kind of what it felt like. And in San Andreas, it helped me learn the layout of the city.
Yeah.
That each time you drove back home, eventually... earlier and earlier you'd go, "Oh right, if I take this right then this left, I'm now on Grove Street, now I know I'm back home." And so I enjoyed in Dark Souls 2, I know the map isn't as intricate as the original Dark Souls, but it does spiral off in four different directions, and I quite enjoyed reaching the end point of one of those directions, defeating the final boss there, and then sort of hotline Miami-ing my way all the way back through the map I'd just been in, because that's kind of how you see more of the secrets and stuff like that. And then hearing the familiar music of Majula, the hub area, which is my favorite hub area of all the Souls games. And that actually, there was a real coziness to it, but I loved it, an otherwise very bleak game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was, it really felt like a home territory, especially because one thing I do enjoy about the Souls games is the sort of the acquisition of NPCs throughout. You meet people and they end up back at your hub area, and in Dark Souls 2, you're just collecting more and more of
them. Yeah, yeah.
And so in those moments of real bleakness, that the idea of I will eventually be in Majula, I will eventually be home, would always really sort of brighten it for me. And I like how dark and bleak those games can get. I love that in Dark Souls 2, in that hub area, you've got this menacing open pit in the middle, and you can't even really get down there quite easily until you either, you know, use spells or you meet Laddersmith Gilligan, I think his name was, the guy who sells ladders, which is not an easy career. But I love any moment in those games where you just plummet below the earth, you just get lower and lower. And I really enjoyed, you know, the first level down that pit is the sewers full of rats, and it's still man-made, it's still, you know, it's still deliberate. And then below that, you end up in what is essentially Blighttown again. And then you go down even further into an area called Black Gulch, which is just so, so low underground. You're so far away from the nearest natural life source. And then at the very lowest point, you open up these double doors, and there's this elderly man sat in the chair, and he just sort of who's this sort of dark master guy. And it's just, it was just so lonely and bleak. And to then defeat the boss in that area, and then you end up back in that home territory, it felt like sort of coming up for air from underneath the duvet. I just really, really enjoyed that for a series that I couldn't have hated more. I used to sort of almost hate read forums about it, just baffled about how people were sort of proudly saying, no, Dark Souls isn't here to impress you. You're here to impress Dark Souls. And it was like, who the fuck does this game think it is? And it just baffled me. And then suddenly to really...
It is annoying if you're not part of the club. Yeah, it is a bit annoying.
But that whole get good atmosphere, I just didn't like. And actually, since playing those games, I've never encountered it. It's one of the most supportive communities you could ever find. The feeling of bringing people into your own world and them helping you out of boss fights and stuff, it's such a fun peer-to-peer experience that I've never really experienced anywhere else. I just love it so much, and everything just felt so iconic, from the new location sound, from everywhere you go, to the enemy defeated sort of different tagline that you get in each of the game. And then finally, the most recent one when I got a PS5, the first game I got for PS5 was Demon Souls, and to be able to finally sort of
returned with all your new skills.
Yeah, because at the time I was the only other person I knew who had a PS5 was Dara O'Brien. I remember talking to him during a tech rehearsal for Not the Week, and he was saying he just started Demon Souls, and he was like, "You can't save. How do you save?" And I was like, "Oh, look, I was in this situation 12 years ago. Trust me, just keep playing. Please keep playing." And I really hope he has.
That's brilliant. I love, one other thing I like about Dark Souls 2 is a story that I think Miyazaki, who is the architect of the series, was working on Bloodborne at the time. So he gave Dark Souls 2 like the world design, which he'd always typically done himself. He gave it to some of his genius to allow them to cut their teeth. And
yeah,
it's just a really lovely external story, obviously, from the game itself, but about, you know, that sense of relinquishing a bit of control and letting other people sort of, you know, have practice. And
it's such a lovely side to it. And I'm aware it's not the best one. I probably truly don't believe it is. I think Dark Souls is the better location. 3 is the best bosses. Bloodborne's probably got the best combat. But it was something really special. And it was, you know, I'm so obsessed with Miyazaki as a figure. And every interview I've ever read, and I've read so much sort of around it, and there's an excellent book called You Died, which is this companion piece to it, and I love even just talking about the different locations and the bosses. Just everything about it is just so brilliant, and I'm now constantly preaching and boring people, convincing them to give it a go.
Right, let's get back to your story then, Glenn. So when you were a kid, did you want to be a performer?
Yeah, definitely. Right? I definitely wanted to go into acting to some extent. And I think my parents were really encouraging about that, in terms of the school I went to did absolutely nothing with regards to, there was no school play or anything. There was just nothing. And so there were no sort of opportunities. So when I was in secondary school, you had to be in lower sixth or upper sixth, so the final 2 years of secondary school, that's when you'd be eligible to audition for the play. And then, but once a decade or so, they'd do a staff pantomime. And so when I was finally in my first year of being eligible, was a staff pantomime, so I wasn't allowed to be in it. And then in my final year, they decided, oh, we're going to do a production of Oliver, so we want the youngest kids.
Oh, right, yeah.
So then they completely reversed it. But I would do sort of outside of school Amdram sort of stuff for kids and stuff like that, and loved it, and was, and there were various sort of people involved in those sort of things who would sort of saying to my parents, I think he should go into it.
Did you audition for Harry Potter? Yeah. Is that right?
I had an audition, like, oh, well, you really bring up stuff that stings, Simon.
And oh, sorry.
No, not at all. No, it was basically at the time, I had an audition lined up for, you know, to read for the role of Harry Potter. And it just kept getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. And then I went on holiday with my family, and I remember us being in Spain and my mum just going, oh, Glenn, no. And the front cover of every newspaper was these pictures of Daniel Radcliffe. And before I'd even had an audition, they'd like gone, nope, no, call off the search, we found him. I was obviously absolutely gutted, but I think my parents have been sort of quite sensible in terms of just sort of like, pursue it if you sort of in your free time, don't dedicate your life to it, because you, the chances of making anything of it professionally are just as small if you just did it, if you went to the occasional audition whilst having a full-time job in something else, or, you know. And so that, I think they were quite keen for me to sort of not to, and that's absolutely fine, and I don't sort of regret that at all. And and I think actually stand-up at first felt like a decent enough, not sort of replacement for it, but an opportunity to perform where you can easily just perform most nights of a week and make money for it, as opposed to trying to, you know, get cast in a 6 month long run of a play or anything like that, where you're then committing to a job for ages. It's the nice thing about stand-up is you sort of pick and choose your days, and you go along to do a gig in some such town or a gig in some such town.
Okay, we better come to your second game, Glenn.
Yes.
Can you tell us about this one, and what's the emotion that this one's hitting for you?
Okay, this one is Pastoral Coziness, and it's The Witcher 3. This is in my top three games of all time. It was my first PS4 game. I played it in 2015, so I think the year that it would have come out. And I'd just been at the Edinburgh Festival, and I came home elated. Usually, I'd done the Edinburgh Fringe twice previously, but as part of a double act, and that's what I'd just done in 2015 as well. And at the time, was still doing any temp job, any office temp job I could during the day. I was working as a journalist, as a freelance newsreader, on the weekends, and then was doing gigs 6 or 7 nights a week anyway, so I was just permanently sort of working. And each time I left the Edinburgh Festival, which is an exhausting month of performing, I'd basically get an early morning train and take that train straight to like Sky News, and then do an afternoon evening shift, and then just keep working forever. And it was exhausting. And so 2015 was the first time that I was leaving the Edinburgh Fringe going, right, comedy's now my full-time thing, it's now my full-time job. And I had a few opportunities on the horizon. I'd just met my now fiance. I was just feeling the high as a kite. I was so sort of elated. And to exacerbate that sort of even further, whilst at the Edinburgh Fringe, I'd ordered a PS4 with a copy of The Witcher waiting for me when I sort of got home. And I initially wasn't keen on the idea of The Witcher. I didn't like the look of him. I didn't like the look of Geralt. I thought it looked like a nasty sort of game. Not that I'm sort of pearl clutching about that sort of thing. I, for instance, loved the original God of Wars, but it looked like the original God of War. He looked like the original Kratos. He looked like a dick, and I thought, oh, is he gonna be a dick? And I didn't mind that in God of War, but I kind of thought in a real nice sort of fantasy setting of nice sort of villages and rolling fields, I don't really want to be like the protagonist from Atomic Heart. If like a kind villager's like, how can I help you, sir? And you're like, fuck off. I didn't want it to be like that. And then I've been told by a few people, this game is absolutely incredible. And so I got back from the Edinburgh Festival, had this, I'm at a shiny new PS4, and I had a load of camembert and cheese and loads of like Belgian wheat beer. I was basically like eating and drinking like Geralt, and I started playing it, and it was just
singing in the bathtub.
Exactly, yeah, with a weird scorpion thing in. It was everything I want. I mean, I've been so led in here by an aesthetic. Obviously, it's the aesthetic talking here, but I was just so that I just felt so just blissfully happy. And it was everything I'd always wanted in sort of video games. I love a tavern, anything like that. I love a sort of countryside setting. And so Final Fantasy IX was probably my first experience of that as a kid. And I just fell in love with Final Fantasy IX. I fell in love with kind of the scale of those sort of things. Opening that game up and finding it had four discs was just mind-blowing to me. And I loved then things like Dragon Quest VIII or Kingdom Come Deliverance. Any games like that where, yeah, the cities are always cool, but I just really cared more about those tiny little villages and stopping off for the night in an inn and playing cards and everything like that. And it was it's probably the longest game that I've completed more than once. I finished it three times. But the first time I just did...
Really?
First time was in 2015. I just played through many through them. Main missions and a fair few of the side missions, but accidentally missed a few.
Yeah.
And then I went back to it the following year and was like, right, every main mission, every side quest, and this time get me a good ending because I kind of got the middle ending. And then in 2018, forced myself, once I'd had the DLC as well, was like, okay, I can't stop thinking about this game. I can't stop listening to the soundtrack. It's on my mind a lot. Every time I play another game, all I'm thinking is it's not really The Witcher 3. So I was like, okay, in a sort of like, oh, you got caught smoking, so your parents make you smoke the whole packet sort of way. I was like, I'm going to give myself an agonizing Witcher 3 experience in which I do every single question mark, every single into that map, and I'm going to force myself to get so bored of the game I'll never ever play it.
Did it work?
Yeah, I felt like I'm ready to say bye to it.
You feel like you're done now.
But I still think about it a lot. And it's just because the writing was excellent. The characters were so, I fell in love with the characters. I really liked Geralt. I fell in love with Yennefer, then fell in love with Triss, and fell in love with Kira Metz, and just every single character was excellent. I don't mean in a romantic way. I wasn't making body pillows out of them, but like it was just I just loved and cared about everyone so much.
Geralt kind of falls in love with all three of them, though, doesn't he? I think
he absolutely does.
Romance all of them, can't you? So
yeah, and I think I did each time. But I think to have a game of that size where none of the quests are rote or really sort of repeated, every side quest, every contract you went on just spiraled off in a different direction and was so exciting. And I know a lot is said about the Bloody Baron quest as being like this huge sort of achievement in gaming, but I just found that every mission was...
Yeah, it's very well written, definitely.
It was just never boring. It was just... And the diversity of the regions as well. The fact that White Orchard's probably about the size of Vice City, and that's just the tutorial. Then it opens up into Velen and Novigrad. Novigrad is a huge, huge city. Then to open into Skellige, where each of these islands had their own individual stories and clans, and you'd sort of solve the story of that island and move on to the next one. I mean, the fact that the DLC, the Toussaint, the enormous sort of south of France sort of region, was just incredible. And again, it really fulfilled that love I have of pastoral coziness, of stopping at the Cockatrice Inn on that bridge in Tucson and Geralt having a red wine there was just like, this is amazing. I feel so cozy. It was
living vicariously.
Yeah, it was
Geralt,
just, I must have come from reading Redwall books as a kid or something like that, but I just,
yeah,
it was, yeah, it's so rare that a game just makes me feel that consistently elated.
I think one of the things I really liked about The Witcher was, so often in open world games, the map just becomes this sea of little missions that you've got to do, markers, and the psychic toll of like opening your map and saying, oh, I've got 50 million things that I need to do before I can move on. And The Witcher, they just don't do that. They have like two or three things quite often that are like, these are your three options for what you can do next. And it feels much more manageable and less like it's a game that's been built by various teams all around the world, mentioning no names, Ubisoft, but you know, some of those games could just, you know, they feel like they're filling out the world for the sake of it, whereas this was much more crafted.
Yeah, and because a lot of those missions will be like, well, collect three Imperial Guard armors for me now, and there was none of that. There was no collect this amount of things.
Right, yeah.
Everything had a purpose and a reason and was relevant, and everyone felt relevant. Every position of every NPC, every village felt important and useful, and it was a place where you could almost sort of people watch, and you go into a bar and feel convincingly, all these people are having a night out, this is what's happening. Whereas I haven't really encountered that much in other open world games. Nothing really feels as lived in and as real as that, barring maybe Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah.
Nothing else feels that organic and true, I think.
Yeah, very true.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So you mentioned there that you were for a while a journalist and working as a newsreader.
Yeah.
I read that you had to, like, before you could do that, you had to get a master's in journalism. And to do that, you wrote your dissertation on the economic impact of the Edinburgh Festival so that you could go and perform there while you were doing your research.
That was exactly what happened. Yeah, I knew that from the age of about five that I was like, okay, if acting is a potentially frivolous, full of pitfalls sort of career, then I need something deadly serious. Grown-up serious that hopefully would allow me to sort of, I don't know, to sort of perform to some extent, because I knew I wanted to sort of do that.
Yeah.
And I just decided from about the age of five I wanted to be a newsreader, which is so strange for a child to want to do. So went to uni knowing that's what I wanted to do, and I didn't want to do journalism as a course. I sort of preferred to do something that I was interested in, and so did English Lit, knowing that I'd then go on to do a master's in journalism.
Cool, you had it all planned out. That's amazing.
Yeah, kind of. I was very fortunate in that I fully knew what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But that did then immediately come crashing down the moment I started the master's, because that's when I did my first couple of stand-up gigs. And having done my whole life up to that point, knowing this is what I do with my life, suddenly doing two stand-up gigs and being like, oh, this is more fun. And after the second gig, got offered to do a couple of gigs, and the money was sort of all right, and I was like, oh my God, is it this doable? And I'd entered a stand-up comedy competition called So You Think You're Funny, which I was fascinated by. I'd been running for decades and has been won by, you know, Peter Kay and Lee Mack and all the likes. So many huge acts. And I was fascinated by, on the Wikipedia page, even just the finalists every year, the 10 finalists or so, every single one of them would have, you know, blue hyperlink. They've all got their own Wikipedia page. It's all a household name. It's all people who've gone on to, at the very least, work full-time in comedy. And so I was like, I really want to do this competition.
Right.
And the final sort of involved me sort of, you know, it would involve me going to the Edinburgh Fringe, and I got through to the final. And so in a very cheeky way was like, oh, I'll do a dissertation about the economic impact of the Edinburgh Fringe and just interview loads of comedians and stuff like that. And so that's what I did. And it was kind of, half the questions I was asking comedians were about this dissertation topic, and the other half were more sort of like, so what advice would you give to any budding young stand-up? I used to do that loads. I mean, my first job as a newsreader and a roving reporter, you'd get all these sort of press releases through of just absurd, it's National Sausage Day. And, you know, this PR company would email this through and sort of go, and if you want to talk about sausages, we've got Al Murray available for interviews. So I would just say to my news editor, I'm just going to interview Al Murray. I think it'd be quite good content for the, and you know, the sort of and finally story. And the second half of each interview, I'd just be asking them, how did you do it? What was your backstory? How did you get into this sort of thing? And because I was in a double act at the time, I'd get each of these celebs I interviewed to sort of, I'd very cheekily sort of ask them, can you do it, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage. And, you know, so I remember getting like Michael Palin and Bill Bailey to do that and stuff like that. It was really
amazing.
I was terrified that I was going to sort of get found out. But yeah, so it was just an opportunity for me to sort of juggle both jobs sort of at the same time.
And didn't you have, this is either the journalist's worst nightmare, but when you were doing those interviews for your dissertation, did something go wrong with your recorder or something?
Yes, I got back to Sheffield, where I was living and where I was doing stand-up in the north of England, and listened back, and every piece that I'd recorded had been corrupted. Unusable. And I'd just gone to the Edinburgh Fringe and spent all the little money I did have on that. And so a friend I was in a double act at the time, we were quite good at impressions and doing people's voices and stuff. And so we just sat down one day and just learned how to impersonate every single person I'd interviewed. And you really shouldn't be admitting this. This is, I don't, can they take away a master's? Can they, can they rescind this? This is really bad journalistic practice. It's like, had it been in a professional setting, immensely illegal.
Not only making up quotations, but also impersonating.
But impersonating them. But we did a decent job because we'd intersperse it with footage from their actual stand.
Right.
And actually, you couldn't tell. We had to make sure the impressions were absolutely spot on. But the problem was because there were some fairly famous comedians involved.
Yeah, who did you do?
I said, you know what? I actually, you know what? I'm gonna put a hard limit on that's the amount I'm willing to reveal about that, because it's just, there's still a part of me, even now, that's like, my journalism career is so over anyway. But there's still a part of me that's like, could I lose a qualification over it? I don't know. There's still a part of me that's still pathetically nervous about it. And I wasn't a good journalist because I was scared all the time. I was so scared of screwing up. Because I would screw up enormously like that. And the stakes are so high in terms of, like, if you broadcast the wrong bit of information or stuff, like, sometimes, you know, it can carry a prison sentence. And it was just terrifying. It was so, so terrifying.
Yeah. So let's not dwell too much on that.
But I'm out of it now. I did it up until 2017. That was kind of it. I was a journalist until I was 2017. I was juggling stand-up. And then the last time I did sort of a full news reading shift. I mean, I work on a radio breakfast show on Absolute Radio in the mornings. And if the news reader is ever off sick, then I'll fill in and read the news.
Oh, but that's good.
which is fine, but I still feel very scared to do it. This is why I was like, yeah I could, if I'd lost a qualification, that could be an issue. but my hard out was 2017 was it the last news reading, full news reading shift I ever did was the day before my first episode of Mock the Week. That was the last time.
That's a nice break.
I was like, I should feel comfortable enough. And also I was at LBC and I was freelance so that I could juggle it with stand-up gigs. And you were obviously then put on the graveyard shifts and working, you know, overnights and early mornings, all the shifts that no one else wants to do, which at the time was being the newsreader on Nigel Farage's show or Katie Hopkins.
Right.
So I was usually put as the newsreader on those shows, and I just didn't want that association.
Yeah, you felt like there was some splash damage coming off those characters
a little. Yeah it was so bizarre being in the same, even just the same building
right.
as those people was bizarre, you know, to meet my heroes like that. it was despicable. I really didn't know what to do.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, when you fill in and do those extra bits now, do they pay you extra for that? Or do you just do that as part of
Yes. Because they're like, you're doing two jobs. You're being a co-presenter and you're now having to...
Oh, that's good.
This is shippy.
Okay, let's come to your third game then. Tell us about this one and what it conjures up for you.
So this game is called Darkwood. I don't think enough people know about this game. And I like the way I'm preaching to all my friends about all the Soulsborne games. This is the horror game that I tell everyone about. In terms of the feeling, the theme of it is subversive fear. That is my favorite kind in horror games. I love horror films, and even though so many are bad, and I'm always just looking for one that will just make me frightened of a specific normality in life, you know. I still think Jaws is so effective because if you watch it the day before you're about to go swimming, you will feel uncomfortable.
Right.
My favorite horror film is It Follows, because it made me nervous about just seeing another pedestrian on the same side of the road as me. So I always enjoyed any invasion of a safe space, in especially in games, and ones that do it in a really creative way. So my favorite instance is probably Resident Evil 2. Is already an amazing zombie game, but when Mr. X, this tyrant who's just slowly walking after you throughout the whole game, the vast majority of the game, that was scary enough. But you've got the main forum, the atrium of the police HQ, which is your safe space. Zombies can't come in there. That's where you save your game. And I remember running away from Mr. X, walking into the atrium, and then hearing the door open for these footsteps. And he was in there, and it was like, this wasn't the rule. This wasn't the deal. Yeah. And it was just so scary because it felt like something had broken in the game. It felt like the girl in the ring coming out the TV. It felt like something's gone wrong here. Something's gone wrong with the game because the game has established all these rules. And the most effectively I felt that since has probably been Immortality, which I did insist as a horror game. And the first moment, without spoiling anything, the first moment the game subverts and you sort of get addressed through the screen was really scary. I remember someone recommending it to me and just thinking, how could this be scary? How? It's a top-down video game that's got the graphics of like the original GTAs or like Hotline Miami.
Right.
Not cartoony as such, but definitely not in any way trying to sort of replicate, be realistic or anything like that. And the idea is, it was made by a very small Eastern European company, and it's set in Eastern Europe. And the idea is, the area where you live has just been overgrown almost overnight with just huge trees. It's just become a very difficult to penetrate forest. You have no information. You don't really know who you are. And you've got a sort of safe house. And during the day, you go out scavenging for materials and you try and find just wood and gasoline. And in your safe house, you have this a generator that you pour your gasoline into, and that powers your lights. So you've got those on overnight, and you just barricade with wood and hammer and nails your doors, your windows, and then you'll feel the game starting to get darker and darker and darker, and you realize that was nighttime, and so you always make sure, back in my house by nighttime. And so the first time I was like, the first day of the game, I was like, this isn't that fun. I met a couple of sort of wild dogs that were quite difficult to kill, but I was like, I don't really get it. And then night started to fall, and I was like, okay, right, barricade yourself up in your house. And it's absolutely terrifying. So you're told by the game, don't go outside. At night, don't go outside. Night only lasts for about 5 minutes. But the moment night falls, the game just goes almost completely silent. And you're just stood in the corner of a room with a shotgun pointed at the door. And you've got all these bear traps on the floor in front of you, like Nathan Lane and Lee Evans in Mouse Hunt. Just terrified that someone's going to come in. And what was incredible to me is that usually in a horror game, it stops being scary the first time you die. I love Alien Isolation until you get killed by the alien for the first time and you go, oh, actually, this is okay. But Darkwood throws so many terrifying things at you, and it's so varied in what it does because it is this, the whole game is not explained to you. What has happened to your town is not explained. It's just trying its best to scare you at all times. And sometimes it's a case of, oh, you'll hear someone banging on your window, and sometimes nothing comes of it. Sometimes someone breaks in and it's a weird mutant that will come in and you have to sort of kill them. And your cone of light emanating from your torch is actually quite small. So you're constantly sort of spinning around, and it really gives you that sense of my back's against the wall. I'm terrified. At one time I went into my character's bedroom and there was just a man there overnight, and he was just pleasantly talking to me, and then he vanished. And it was like, this is fucking horrible. And you're just waiting for morning to come. And then what happens is when you wake up in the morning, there's a trader each morning. And if you've survived the night, then he'll be more willing to trade with you and give you good items. And so there is a real impetus to not die. So you really are trying to sort of stay alive. And it's just handed to buy things like a watch so you actually know what time it is. There's nothing worse than being caught out when it's dusk and you're like, I know I'm more than 5 minutes away from home. And right. This is getting scary. And it just really, the terror I'd feel like, I remember going out scavenging one day and coming back and realizing I'd left the generator on all day and I didn't know. And I was like, this generator's not going to make it all the way through the night. And just seeing my lights just slowly get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, maybe like 2 a.m. And I was like, I know I've got a good few minutes of, and just sitting there in silence, just so, so terrified. It's unbelievable. It's a very challenging game, but it was just, I've never known fear in a game like it. It was just unbelievable. And basically the subversive fear that I felt was firstly subversion of looking at a game like that and thinking, there's no way this can be scary based on the visuals. I'm not really one who cares that much about graphics, sure. But when it comes to horror, I kind of need it in order to be more immersed in it. And the other subversive element of fear is throughout the day, your house is the safe space. It's the only place enemies won't come in. And then at night, it is the most terrifying place you've ever been. It's unbelievable. It's such an achievement.
Wow, I think you've sold a few copies of Darkwood there. That sounds amazing.
I'm sorry.
Fantastic. So you, talking of horror, you applied to be on the first civilian mission to Mars a few years ago, is that right? Which is famously a
yes.
journey from which no one will return. Why did you do that?
Yeah, I did. And it was after a breakup, which makes it sound really trouble, doesn't it? It makes it sound really, really trouble. I was I just thought, yeah, why not? It was more to see if I could be accepted. I think it was a case of if I had been, I probably have gone, no, obviously not. But to tell people the rest of your life, oh my God, I got accepted. And I got through a couple of like rounds and stuff like that.
What did they ask you?
Do you know what? Nothing. It was all quite, you sort of, I always can't really remember the process if it involved a sort of university-esque cover letter
right.
or anything like that. But it wasn't, aside from your personal and contact details, there wasn't a tell us why you'd be good. There was nothing like that.
Right.
It was very, very strange. And I ended up writing a stand-up show about it. Like I said earlier, that I'd always make sure that the one true bit of each stand-up show was the least plausible bit. The whole show was built on me applying for a first civilian mission to Mars and what I'd do there and what I'd miss and stuff like that. And then at the end, the big reveal was like, that was real. That was the real bit. In the same way that like I did a show about news reading a year later and it was all clearly falsified. I was talking about a radio station that didn't exist, telling all these silly anecdotes of stuff that clearly never happened. And then at the end was like, told stories about Nigel Farage and Katie Hopkins. And then at the end played like proof to the audience. And it was like, that's the real bit.
Oh, that's a good reveal. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's sort of what prompted it. It was just, it was just on a whim. There was no, I definitely didn't think that decision through at all. I mean, talking right now about my passion for video games, I'd hate it there. And I would have hated it.
Yeah. You're very good at communicating the appeal of games. Tell me how that's worked with your work with the BBC on PressX to start. So how did that come about?
Weirdly, in the middle of lockdown, which was quite nice. I was obviously very scared in lockdown. I was so excited before lockdown that at the time I was writing on an animated movie, and I was meant to be going to LA a few months later to do stand-up on Conan, and was really like, oh my God, this is, I'm so excited about this. And then obviously everything just, abruptly ended. Conan O'Brien retired his show. The movie sort of then dissipated, or it's in sort of development hell, I don't know. So my girlfriend and I, fortunately in lockdown, got like a sort of sitcom script commission. So that was the thing that sort of was giving us purpose every day, and that was giving us sort of routine. And I was able to do the Absolute Radio Breakfast Show from home, and that felt quite nice because we were able to communicate with each other as a group of four presenters, but also it was so nice hearing the listeners get in touch and knowing that, well, actually this is all communal, we're all sort of in this together. And so what happened was I was obviously had more time on my hands, and so started to play loads of video games, far more than I'd ever played before. And I was making an effort to play, just spending a bit more on just sort of really cheap indie video games I'd otherwise never really sort of encountered. I think when I was growing up, I'd maybe get like one video game for Christmas, and then pocket money for me and my sister was probably like £3 a month, so I could only really afford maybe like one video game a year. So if that was the case, I'd buy a big budget, this is the one everyone's talking about, and so would never have played like a small indie title. And so suddenly having all that spare time, I was suddenly playing games like Observation or Kentucky Route Zero and stuff I'd otherwise never really encountered. And just realized about halfway through lockdown, I was like, because a lot of these games only take 3 or 4 hours, I was like, I think I've completed about 80 games. So I started to publicize. I thought, you know what, I'm going to start Twitch streaming, and I'll just, the challenge is to get to 100 by the end of the year. And a friend of mine who works at the BBC sort of got in touch and was like, I didn't realize you are as into video games as you are. And he was like, I think the BBC should have a video games podcast. And he was sort of working as the BBC sort of video game correspondent, and was like, let's sort of put this together. And it became a sort of video game sort of review show, which was wonderful. It was the first time I'd ever not had to pay for video games, which is great. But it was really fun to sort of do that. It made me daunted to be in your position of playing video games to a deadline, you know, being given Assassin's Creed Valhalla maybe 3 days before release, and then having to give a really well thought out review afterwards. It was terrifying. It feels like a real dick thing to, you know, to be able to say, yeah, it just came through a friend of a friend. You know, I felt very fortunate that sort of how it came about. But the podcast sort of took off, and then it became a TV show, which was really fun.
Yeah.
And it, you know, as ultimately it is a video games review show, but it was just people talking about video games and as passionately as they could. And we were all interested in completely different kinds of video games, you know, and it was nice to back sort of help broaden my horizons a bit. I was so limited in terms of the genres I played when I was growing up. That actually it was nice to really sort of look outwardly and play things I would never have encountered.
Okay, on that note, let's come to your fourth game then, Glenn. Tell us about this one.
And I'm very sorry. I'm very, very sorry that I think, again, at the time of recording, this will now be the fourth time it's come up, and I'm sure it's going to come up many, many more times.
There's another couple already.
Oh my God. Well, we're just going to accept it's probably the greatest game of all time, haven't we? It is Disco Elysium. This, as has already been covered many times before, is, you know, it's an isometric CRPG in which you are this drunk alcoholic cop who wakes up in a hotel with absolutely no memory of who you are, and there's a dead body outside, and you realize, oh, I'm a cop who's meant to be investigating this dead body. And you and your colleague Kim Kutsuragi basically go around the town and you just solve it as a typical sort of murder mystery. But as an RPG, it's so fascinating that in terms of building up your character, it's so much more than just putting points into raw strength and stuff like that. Those are aspects of it, but you're essentially playing as a brain. Your skills are split into 24 basically brain categories that do range from stuff that makes sense like logic, but then they get more and more obscure to the point of like savoir faire. Your sense of fashion, which the more points you put into it, the more your clothes start talking to you. And, you know, the way the game works is you've obviously got what you can see on screen of the characters, but you've got this sidebar down the side of a screen, which is just this relentless barrage, both of dialogue from the people you talk to, but also in between. It's a bit like Peep Show, the sitcom, in a sense of that you're constantly, the dialogue's constantly being interrupted by these 24 different categories of your brain communicating to you and talking to you about stuff. And I just haven't experienced anything like it. And it is a miracle. It's a Beatles-esque miracle of gaming in that so many different things have to go right and so many amazing ideas and unique ideas have to come together that you are balancing these 24 different characters almost. And it's fun that it is in the body of this shambling alcoholic cop. And, you know, it doesn't play out like a normal RPG. I played it wrong the first time I played it. I safe scummed beyond belief.
Right.
I try to max out certain skills, and it's quite interesting that the game isn't meant for maxing out, because you actually go more insane the more you do that. I put all my points into Encyclopedia, and the game became this book of information being thrown at me at all times. So you've got to kind of balance that out, and I try and pass every skill check. And actually, that's not how the game's meant to be played at all. It's a brilliant game about failure. And what is so incredible about the game and the way it's written is everything feels canon. Everything you do feels like this was the only way the game was meant to be played. And actually, in Disco Elysium, each failed skill check, because it's all done on dice rolls, each failed skill check actually then tails off into its own happy conclusion, and it feels real, it feels organic, and it feels like it makes sense in terms of your character. In terms of what emotion, what category this falls under, is shame. What Disco Elysium does so well with regards to shame is your shame has been sort of preordained, because you've woken up with no memory, and you can be as nice as you want to people, but your past is tailing you. What you did the previous night before you were playing the game is always going to catch up with you. And I was trying to talk to this cafe, this hotel where you sort of wake up. I was told that, oh, you know, there was a waitress here last night who was a witness to the murder. She'll be able to tell you something. And I ring her up and I'm trying to be really nice to her, and she's really off with me, and I don't know why. And then she's like, because last night you were joking about suicide and you were running around with your gun in your mouth, going around to people's, and it felt really shameful. Yeah. And I felt really, really bad that I was like, I can't do anything about that. I'm being the whole game is you just getting told off by people. your colleague, Kim, who's such a brilliantly written character, I'd feel so embarrassed every time it would say Kim raises an eyebrow, Kim mutters and writes down his notepad. I'd be like, no, I don't want to disappoint him. There's this wonderful Greek tragedy-esque element of unchangeability to it, that these wheels were all put in motion long before you started playing. It's so extraordinarily well written. It's so poetic. It's just this unparalleled level of brilliance throughout that I just found astonishing.
Yeah, very nice. So you recently sold a script, your first film. I think, did you write that with your fiance?
Yes, yeah. In fact, it was the sitcom script that we'd had commissioned right. in lockdown. Amazing. Basically, initially there was a big star sort of attached to it, and that's why we were sort of writing the sitcom in the first place. Then, because of scheduling stuff, they couldn't do it, and so then the sitcom just ended up sort of back in our hands. And we were sort of a bit gutted about that, but then we sort of got approached by a movie company recently, and we sort of went, oh, we've got this thing that was a sitcom, but we think could be a film. And they wanted it, and so we're sort of writing that together, and it felt nice. It felt like, oh, right, lockdown wasn't a waste of time. That was the King Lear. We did that. Okay, right. That's fine. You know, we consider it. And so it's fun to revisit something that, you know, that we did sort of a few years ago. Usually I'd look back at any old joke or any stand-up show I've written with such a sense of remorse and shame that jokes are something I do get quite self-conscious about, and you sort of feel a bit...
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Or creative art in general, but you sort of look back and say, oh, God, was I...
Yeah, yeah.
Do I think that was impressive?
It's the same in writing as well, so yeah.
Of course, yeah. And it fully makes sense for it to be. And actually, it's quite nice to look back at this script and sort of go, oh, no, we still remain very sort of proud of this. And that's quite nice, and it's a completely different avenue for us. We don't know what the hell we're doing. We'd never... in a film before, but
so what was it before, like a six half-hour episodes or something that you're now turning into a 90-minute film?
Yeah, with the and obviously when pitching sitcoms, it's all about you're trying to say to them, this will run and run, this will be Frasier, this will run for decades, you know. And and so to suddenly be sort of like, right, this will run for 90 minutes and it'll be really fully wrapped up is suddenly completely the opposite of what we were saying.
There's no room, nothing else to this story.
It's quite fun writing it it's very fun writing it with a partner as well. You know, we had to sort of cross that bridge a few years ago when writing together of, right, we need to feel comfortable saying to each other that joke is bad, don't, you know, and not to feel hurt by it or anything like that. Was the first sort of, and we had to make sure we got over that immediately, and that was really easy to get over. And we write for each other quite a lot, and she's written for me for sort of shows I've done, and I write for her when she's writing on stuff as well. So that's quite a nice sort of dynamic, and it's quite nice that I think it's fortunate that she's purely on the writing side of thing and I'm mostly on the performing side of things, because it means there's never any envy over, I think, if we were both, say, stand-ups.
Yeah, what opportunities you're getting or whatever.
Yeah, and if, you know, and then I think back, of course there'd be envy there. But actually, at the moment, you know, with this, it's just purely sort of supportive, which is nice.
Oh, lovely. Right, Glenn, we better come to your fifth game here. So did this one come out during lockdown? I can't remember. Anyone, tell us.
It did. It was meant to come out early in lockdown and ended up coming out in June or July of 2020. This comes under the topic and theme of woodlands and small towns of America. It's The Last of Us Part 2. Honestly, it's up there with pastoral coziness. I love tall pines, misty, you know, wood paneled buildings. Even though The Last of Us is a bleak post-apocalyptic version of that, it's such an in-depth realization of a particular environment, and I found it endlessly fascinating to just, especially in the second game. It is my favorite game of all time, and I felt confident saying it the moment I completed it, even though I was like, give me, you know, no recency bias, this is difficult, but looking back, it's so good. I never want to play it again, because I'm like, that was a perfect moment for me. That was a perfect game playing experience. The sheer effort that has gone into the game and the care and just the amount of variations you have when just even opening a door and stuff like that was just incredible. I loved The Last of Us Part 1, and I felt empty every time I replayed it when there was the ending and it just cuts off, and I can't be the end of it. I know it is, and I know that's so powerful and it's so effective, and I regret the first time I played Last of Us because I played it very stupidly. I wasn't expecting it to be as intelligent and deep as it was, and so just played it as a mindless zombie game because that's what I thought it was, and I think in the same way, the first time as a kid I saw like Fight Club and Gladiator, I was expecting it to be like Street Fighter, like it's all about the next fight that's coming up, you know. And so that's kind of how I played The Last of Us. I just didn't really assess the development of Joel and Ellie's relationship throughout. I was just enjoying the road trip, I guess. And then at the end, when Joel's storming the hospital and killing everyone, I was like, yeah, fucking kill them, they're trying to kill Ellie, yeah. And I didn't question his actions at all. It was so thick of me, so thick. But it wasn't until I replayed it, I was like, my God, this is incredible. And I loved Left Behind, the DLC, but even then, because it was a prequel, I was like, no, I just want to know what happens next. I need to know what happens next. And for a game that had such a powerful ending, to then do something so powerful and interesting in the second game, to sort of do that twice over was incredible in a different direction. That sort of Rashomon-esque, let's see the game from an entirely different perspective halfway through, at first disappointed me, because it's the first half ends on such a cliffhanger. But suddenly when the realization came in of, I'm going to play as a second person all the way up until this point again, I was like, I can't do another 15 hours of this before I find out what happens to Ellie. And I was gutted about that. But then it then made me so interested in that, oh, it is incredible that I enjoyed having these debates with people of, are you Team Ellie, are you Team Abby? For everyone I knew who hadn't played the first, they were all Team Abby, and I was always going to be Team Ellie, and I loved it. I think it's so incredibly well written. And I feel as well that a lot of the criticism that it received, all the criticism to me, it always comes down to the conclusion of, yes, because it's good. A lot of the criticism of it felt like kind of, at school, if you were well behaved and you did something wrong, you'd be told off more than the naughty kid would be, because the teacher would be like, I expected this if days have gone. I didn't expect this for The Last of Us, you know. That's kind of what it felt like. I think most of the criticism comes from the violence, but it's like, well, I do think there is a point to that, because we are viewing the game from two people's perspectives, including the victim of the protagonist. So yeah, I think it is assessing violence to some extent. It's exploring how flawed these protagonists are. The game is incredibly violent, but I didn't really see that the first time. I think I was just quietly shooting people in the head or strangling them, and actually it didn't really feel that violent. And I think some of the violence I've seen since, of people using, you know, sort of exploding arrows and you blow someone in half and they're still screaming, is obviously horrifying. But like, the game doesn't make you do that. And so I feel like,
You're player blaming.
Yeah, exactly. If you're sort of like, I killed this guy, and then next to him, I'd fired bullet holes into the ground into the shape of Hitler. Do you think that's acceptable? And it's like, the game didn't tell you so. It's just, it was, yeah. I loved the setting. I loved the story. And it was a game I'd been waiting for years, because I just wanted to see what happened next. And it was everything I could have wanted. And it's a Naughty Dog that just masters at making big budget cinematic games. Uncharted's excellent, and Last of Us as well. And it's good to see a game of such a high budget just care about the artistic integrity of it, and care about the actual arty creative side of it. And the level of detail is just unparalleled. And also lovely pine trees, lovely houses, really into it.
Wonderful. I keep thinking about, I could probably like shoot bullets into the ground in the shape of a swastika. I don't know if I could do it in the shape of Hitler.
Oh, and Lord knows I've tried, but
okay, we better look back. So this is, Glenn, you're going to have to help me out with maybe the emotions that, or the feelings that each of these games conjures. But we've got, so Dark Souls 2, which I think evokes a sense of home and sanctuary and the joy of finding a shortcut. We've got the Witcher 3, which is your love of the rural France.
Yeah, countryside coziness.
Okay. Darkwood, which is the horror of a safe space being invaded.
Subversive fear.
Disco Elysium.
Shame.
What was it for this one? Shame, that's it, of course. How could I forget? and then lastly, The Last of Us Part 2, which is all about the homeliness of rural...
The woodlands and small towns of America, yeah.
Wonderful. Okay, what a console. So, Glenn, what are we going to name this thing?
God 2.
Bigger than God.
I was initially trying to think of an acronym, and actually the acronym I settled on was Glenn's Original Device, and it does make sense that, okay, let's rival some deities,
right? Yeah.
So yeah, it was that's what it is. I don't think it's a very varied console, and I think some of the games possibly it's all very recent. It's all very, they're all very recent games, but they're just incredibly powerful ones.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. Great. Okay, so the God 2, we'll put that out. God the sequel. Yeah. okay, lastly, so I'm going to get you to... I normally ask a question here, but I'm actually going to get you to pay back that thing that you made all those comedians do. Could you do Introducing to the Stage, My Perfect Console for me?
Right, okay. Yeah. So wait, what do you want me to say? So
whatever you would get the comedians to say when you would do this.
Okay, all right. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming out tonight. Welcome to the stage, My Perfect Console. It's got to.
The crowd goes wild. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, that's been great. Thank you so much, Glenn. I've loved hearing your choices and your really thoughtful perspective on each of these games. It's been absolutely great. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Simon.
Thank you so much to my guest there, Glenn Moore. I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. What a lot of fun it was. And really appreciated Glenn's deep thinking and explanation behind each of his game choices. He'd really figured out what it was behind each one of these games that was appealing to him. And a really fun way of articulating that, I think, with the different themes. Great choices as well. And it's fantastic to see Glenn's career blazing off and all the success that he's enjoying at the moment. And I've not spoken to him before. I've not met Glenn before, but it's funny sometimes in these situations you interview someone and you're like, oh, it feels like you're chatting to a buddy. And I certainly felt that during that conversation. So thank you to Glenn for agreeing to come on and for being so open and generous with his time and with his thoughts as well. You can follow Glenn on Twitter. You'll be able to find him easily. You can watch clips of his stand-up, his appearances on Mock the Week and all the other shows that we talked about on YouTube and elsewhere. He also posts clips regularly to Twitter. So go and follow him and follow his work. You can also listen to the radio show that he presents on Absolute Radio as well. So lots of ways to connect with Glenn Moore, hashtag content. And of course, hopefully we'll be seeing this film of his at some point down the line, although these things can take a very, very long time to come to fruition. But fingers crossed that it makes it all the way onto some sort of cinema screen or TV screen or streaming service. So whatever happens, I am certain that we're going to be seeing lots more from Glenn in the future. I would just like to say a huge thank you to those of you who've signed up to become Patreon supporters. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, you just head to www.patreon.com/myperfectconsole, and there for just $5 a month you can become a My Perfect Console subscriber. You get all sorts of great benefits from that. So each month I do a reveal of the four guests that are going to be coming up in the weeks to come. You will also have the chance to ask some of those guests questions and some bonus episodes in which I put some of those questions to the guests. You also get your episodes early, ad-free, and later on this year you'll have the chance to vote in the knockout competition to discover which is the guest's best My Perfect Console of the Year. So all sorts of things to get involved with there. Please do come along. If you use the Patreon app as well, Patreon very kindly has given us access to a beta feature. We've got something called a lounge on there, which means that you can communicate to me and to other supporters and, you know, get chatting in there. It's a nice place. You can do that. And yeah, there's not many patrons around that have that feature yet. They're just sort of trying it with us for some reason, but come and give that a go. It's essentially like Discord, but you don't have to leave the Patreon universe to access it. In other news, very excited to announce that we'll be doing our first My Perfect Console live, a live recording in September in London. We would love to see you there. This is going to be as part of the WASD-IGN Games event that is happening at the Truman Brewery in London from the 14th of September. So this is a games event. There's going to be hundreds of games unreleased and that you can go and play and watch and see, and you can meet other game fans and go to a careers fair. There's all sorts of stuff going on. If you head to the website, the WASD website, then you can read up on what's going on at that event. One of the things that's going on is at 7 p.m. on Thursday, the 14th of September, we'll be doing the live record of the podcast. Tickets cost just £5. They do require a day pass to WASDXIGN. But if you have that day pass, it's £5 to come along to the record. And the guests are going to be announced in coming weeks. But for now, if you head to www.wasdlive.com/tickets, you can pick up your tickets and come along to My Perfect Console Live. How exciting! Please do come. It would be great to see you. I know that we're going to have a really good time. You can also write to me at myperfectconsole@gmail.com with any thoughts, suggestions, any guest suggestions. Loads of you do that. It's really, really helpful. I try to respond to all of you. Apologies if I've neglected to do so. But please know that everything gets read, and it's all going into my big spreadsheet of people to talk to and approach. So please continue to do that. And if you do have a spare moment, then just hop on Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and a review. And if you haven't subscribed yet, why not? Yeah, click the subscribe button. All that junk that we have to say as part of our life doing this sort of thing. I will be back again next week. We've got a great run of guests coming up. We've got a great run of guests that we've had in the past as well. So if you haven't, then dip into the back catalogue and catch up on some of those episodes as we build out the My Perfect Console universe, the MPCU, as someone on Twitter described it as. There's lots of great discussions and interviews for you to go back and enjoy as well. So please do that. Otherwise, I will be back again next week with one new guest, their 5 game choices, and one more perfect console. Until then, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.